quite possibly the most famous line in film history.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
That's Don Vito Corleone telling his Frank Sinatra-esque godson that he's going to make a studio head think twice about not casting him in an upcoming movie. That studio head later wakes up with the severed head of a racehorse in his bed. According to the website PhraseFinder, author Mario Puzo appears to have been making a reference to an existing phrase so that the Godfather character could ironically pretend that his offer was benevolent. Specifically, the site references the 1934 movie Burn 'Em Up Barnes, in which oil speculators negotiate with a woman who has inherited property only to find out that she's found another suitor.
Drummond, I've got to have that land. There's millions of dollars worth of oil under it.
Don't worry, Mr. Warren. I'll make her an offer she can't refuse.
In the wake of her husband Dorian's death, Pamela Neer is presented with offers she couldn't refuse, both of the literal and ironic varieties. So how was it that she turned them all down?
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The State versus Pam Lanier. This is the second in a series of four episodes on the case of Pam Lanier, who was convicted of murder in North Carolina based upon the poisoning death of her husband, Doran, in 1997. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and as always, I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at theviewfromll2.com.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In order to understand Pam Lanier's decisions, let's go back, all the way back to November 9th, 1955. On that day, Pam was born to Shirley and Herbert Whitey Sanders in Chinkapin, North Carolina. Shirley was raised across the street from where Pam grew up and was the 10th of 10 children. Her father was a farmer, and their house had no electricity or indoor plumbing. Whitey was the 7th of 7 children, whose father was a sharecropper during the Great Depression. After serving in the Korean War, Whitey returned home to a career in civil service. Shirley and Whitey married when she was 17 and he was 21. When they were 20 and 25, Pam was born. The family first lived in a $25 a month two-room house with no bathroom before moving to a home near Shirley's parents when Pam was very young.
Before that, we lived in a house up the street. The things I can remember is waking up one Christmas morning and there was a wagon with this dog in it. We wanted a dog so bad. And that Christmas morning, that dog was sitting in that wagon.
When Pam was three, her brother Greg was born.
And how was your relationship like with him?
Real good. Yeah. I was 3 years older. Matter of fact, he's in the hospital today. He had shoulder surgery yesterday. He'll be 60 in October, and I'll be 63 in November, and we were pretty tight. Mm-hmm. If I would go out, and he didn't, you know, before he got his license, I would take him with me. So we were pretty tight.
In 1960, Whitey built the family a new house across the street from Shirley's parents. After Pam's maternal grandfather passed away, her maternal grandmother moved in with the family when Pam was 7 years old. Pam recalls going out and cutting twigs that she would chew to feather up the ends so her grandmother could use them to dip into her snuff or chewing tobacco. She describes playing in the field and a barn that had tobacco stalks across the street. The Calvary Free Will Baptist Church in Hawes Run was a central fixture of Pam's childhood.
My father and mom was both in Free Will Baptist Church, and my father led the singing from the choir in the congregation, and we knew Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night was young people's night. We were to be in charge. If we had dates, then we waited. Either they went to church with us or we couldn't go with them afterwards. So it was kind of that, you know, if they wanted to see us bad enough, me or my brother, they had to go with us, go to church.
Pam tested pretty well on standardized tests, but she wasn't that great of a student. Her description of her schoolhouse days brings to mind Pippi Longstocking. While some of their students were serious, Pam was footloose and fancy free.
And what was school like for you? Did you enjoy school? Was it sort of...
I was mischievous, okay. I'm being honest.
And in what way were you mischievous? Pulling pranks?
Well, no, not exactly pranks, but I was mischievous. I'm the girl that climbed on top of the school breezeway in front of the flag so they could take pictures. Nobody else would do it. I went up there and done it for them, you know, and let them take pictures to go into yearbooks and things. So I was just always the one that I was in one class that, I'm trying to think, all of them was a history class, U.S. history. I was the only girl out of 30-some guys. So naturally, I didn't do no work, you know, pretty much. I was full. I had real long hair, and they would brush my hair. And, you know, the teacher, that was his first year there, and he took me to the library to take the exam, and he told me, he says, let me tell you something, Pamela. If I ever have another one in there like you in that class, I'm quitting. Next year, he didn't even work. He said, I run him off. But I really wasn't bad, but I was just mischievous.
Pam's friend, Lisa Paget, who eventually would marry Pam's brother, describes Pam in a similar fashion.
What were your impressions of Pam growing up?
She's a typical person her age. I mean, you know, she was always sweet. And, she would be rowdy like other people, but nothing out of the way. I never knew her to ever be harmful to anyone.
That's how many people describe Pam. A rowdy exterior and a sweet, caring interior. According to Pam's mother, Shirley, that altruistic core has weathered 2 decades in prison.
Well, Pam was always got along with people good, and she was always trying to help if she could. In fact, she's about to wear us to death right now because she's up there and we're here trying to help us out. So I'd say she's a very loving, caring person.
And when you say she's trying to help you out, how is she trying to help you out?
Oh, she calls the first thing. How y'all? How y'all? Are y'all all right? Are y'all all right? I says, Pam, we're all right. But if we want, what could you? She says, I don't know what I could do. But she says, I just got to do, you're all right. So.
And 2 things stand out about Pam from high school. 1, she was in the homecoming court. And 2, during her 3 years of high school, she would drive kids to school on a bus as a side job.
I even went to bus rodeo.
That's what's bus rodeo?
Where they pick someone from the school to go that they think's capable. It's like a horse rodeo. You have barrels, and you go in and out of barrel. Why are you laughing?
I'm trying to imagine a bus jumping over a barrel.
They go in and out. Like, they have barrels like riding a horse. And you go in and out. Every who's skillful enough to go in and out through the barrels. And then they have you to put it in reverse, and you go back and forth with them. And, you know, you do all this stuff. This just a rodeo-like thing. That's what it was called, a bus rodeo. Okay. And I come in second for our school.
As we touched upon last episode, Pam got married young, at age 18, to her high school sweetheart, Dennis Parker, and they moved down to Miami where he had family.
And what was life like in Miami? How long were you there?
I don't know. It was less than a year. It was all right, but it wasn't home. Mm-hmm. I think that was more infatuation than anything. You know, it was just high school, I don't know, but it was kind of like that.
After returning to North Carolina and ending her marriage with Dennis Parker, Pam worked at Marine Corps Exchange for the next several years. At the time, Pam got to know Mac Lamons, who was married to her friend Lisa Goodson. Lamons and Goodson later got divorced, and when Pam was in her mid-20s, she started dating him. According to Pam, she liked him for his looks and the fact that he loved to go to clubs and dance. The two got married in 1980, and Pam gave birth to their son Dustin in 1983. According to Pam, after Dustin was born, Mac and she began to drift apart. He would go out partying and leave Pam at home to take care of Dustin. And when Mac would drink, a darker side began to emerge.
We would argue and fight a lot, and you want to be the truthful, I would get the crap beat out of me every now and then. But other than that, if he wasn't drinking, he was all right.
So when he drank, he got abusive?
Kind of, pretty much.
According to Pam, the abuse got so bad that she stopped eating and dropped down to 95 pounds. During the marriage, both Pam and Mac worked, but Mac would mostly drink away his paychecks. Pam was working in a mobile home lot on weekdays and at a drag strip on weekends. When Pam finally got sick of Mac's abuse, she decided to divorce him in 1985. Mac was already paying child support for a child he had with Lisa Goodson, so Pam and he came to an agreement.
He had a child by Lisa. He had to pay child support to Brent, so if he paid child support to me, that, you know, he couldn't, and I told him, I said, give me the rights to my son, and I won't never bother you, and I never did.
Right.
And so, after the divorce, Pam was a single mother with a young son and no child support.
And so then after you get divorced, then what's life like before you meet Johnny Ray?
It's hard, kinda. I mean, you know, I got a son, a little boy.
Dustin and she moved into what Pam describes as, quote, a tiny little house that didn't have plumbing for a period of time because she couldn't afford to fix it. Then, in 1986, a year after the divorce, Pam made a bad decision at her job at the mobile home lot.
I was working, and I was in charge of the petty cash and stuff, and it all come through that. But I wasn't, I mean, I was kind of, I was in charge of it, but there was other people that was getting money too out of the deal. I mean, they would have me to give them money for lunch and things like that. So when it did come up short, I was guilty because I was the one in charge of it. And I had used it too for the same thing. So I took the blame for it.
And was that you needed the money, or what was sort of going through your head when you decided to take
it? I don't think it even had nothing to do with needing money. I think it was just basically that, you know, there was food, there was, you know, things that we could have, like, if we wanted to all go out and eat or do whatever, we had it.
Pam would lose her job and eventually plead guilty to misdemeanor embezzlement. Without means to support her son, she took a job at the bacon plant at Holly Ridge, despite it being described to her as a man's job. Pam ran the forklift and would yank the meat off of hogs that were hanging from hooks. On weekends, she would pick blueberries for grocery money and spend Saturdays working at an all-night breakfast place to supplement her income. A year later, in 1987, two friends introduced her to Johnny Ray Williams, but the two didn't get off on the right foot.
I did not know. I was going to with them to a warehouse, tobacco warehouse, closing, and they wanted me to meet somebody named Johnny Williams. And when I went down there, Johnny actually was drunk, and I was introduced to him. And I didn't like him. I mean, I'm being honest, I did not like him. Cute, yes. Liked him, no.
But a few weeks later, Pam and Johnny Ray would hit it off at a party at a horse barn and date throughout 1987. He was a farmer and an auctioneer, and unlike her prior husband, Johnny Ray was even-keeled, even when he was drunk.
Was he ever abusive?
No. Now I have to give him that. He wasn't. He was really, like I said, he was really, if you was to try to be disrespectful to me, like if we were somewhere and say, for instance, Mr. Mark and somebody was having problems and they were using foul language and things like that. And if I was in the presence, he would say, hey, listen, don't do that in front of my wife, you know, or whatever. He was just never, he wasn't like that.
If there's one person in my entire life who gets all the credit for instilling a sense of responsibility in me that, hey, you have to look out for others in this world, you have a responsibility to help make the world a better place, well, that person is my mom. In all the work that I do, I always hear her voice in the back of my head, encouraging me and telling me there's a lot more to be done. And that's why my mom deserves to be celebrated more than one day. Mother's Day is great, but I know your mom probably also deserves more than one day of celebration. Well, now you can give it to her, because when you send her Pro Flowers for Mother's Day, your mom's guaranteed to have at least 7 days of fresh, beautiful flowers. I just recently got my Pro Flowers bouquet full of 24 roses. It's gorgeous. And right now, our listeners can get 100 colorful blooms with a free glass vase starting at just $19.99 plus shipping and handling with our promo code undisclosed. With fresh flowers, guaranteed delivery, and gorgeous vases and accessories that mom will love, Pro Flowers has everything you need to get your Mother's Day shopping done for all the moms you know. The only way to get 100 colorful blooms with a free glass vase starting in $19.99 is to visit proflowers.com. Click on the blue microphone at the upper right corner and use my code undisclosed. Once again, that's proflowers.com, code undisclosed.
Johnny Ray adopted Dustin, and a few years into the marriage, Pam gave birth to their daughter, Kayla, in 1989. The farming life, however, wasn't working out. Johnny Ray eventually ended up taking a job at a bait and tackle shop, and Pam worked at a surf shop, but it wasn't enough to make ends meet. As we noted in episode 1, their property was being foreclosed upon, and they weren't able to pay premiums on Johnny Ray's life insurance policy. And then, at around midnight on September 4th, 1991, Johnny Ray drowned behind the trailer in Surf City, North Carolina. What Pam didn't know is that their insurance agent had paid their premiums up to that point, and she likes to point out that she would have been in dire straits without the money with two young children to raise. But the money she got from the life insurance policy allowed her to turn things around.
So actually, it was a godsend because, you know, here I was living at the beach. I ended up turning it around and buying a double wide and putting it near Mom and Dad and moved from the beach so they could help me with my children, right. Yes.
But it wasn't just the insurance money that changed things. Pam once again started working multiple jobs.
When I was living down there, I worked at Lanier's Restaurant and I worked at Bursar's shop. So I worked quite a bit between the two of them. The surf shop was a full-time job because I was assistant manager on the children and the women's department.
And then after a few years, Pam ran into Dorian Lanier.
How does it come to be that you start the relationship with Dorian?
I guess you would say shenanigans mainly, because it was a nightclub down at the beach. It was a beach club and everybody hung out there. So I would go down and hang out sometimes there, and I kind of got to get more familiar with him down there.
Right. And, you know, having lost Johnny Ray, is this something where you're
this was later.
To enter
yeah,
into
yeah,
it,
this was later after that. Yeah.
And is it sort of a gradual process, or did you two...
No, it was gradual. It was gradual. It wasn't nothing fast.
Dorian was a turkey farmer, and after the two of them got together, Pam decided to try her hand at turkey farming, too, on land that she leased with Tammy Brown, the wife of Dorian's nephew. Pam and Dorian ended up getting married, and Pam sold her double wide so that they could move into a house on Ludie Brown Road that people refer to as the Ludie Brown House.
So the Ludie Brown House is kind of broken down a bit, and you come in and fix it up.
Yes.
According to everyone, things went well for Pam and Dorian at the Ludie Brown House until December 10th, 1996. On that day, Pam came home from work and ran into Dorian and his friend Jackie Hatcher.
I come in from work, and Dorian and Jackie was there. Dorian had told me that he had put some clothes in the dryer, and he says, it smells smoky. He says, I pay attention to it, you know, because there had been, he thought there had been a problem in there. But anyway, when he left, there was a problem. It was fired up a little bit. So I called him and told him to come back. And he come back, him and Jackie did. And he took the washer. He says, I don't know what it is, but he says, there is smoke in here. He says, but I'm going to pull the washer out and put it under the carport and plug in, so you can wash clothes and plug in to an extension cord. And he said, well, a little bit of fire back there is gone. Because there was a little bit of blaze back there. He says, it's gone. He said, you shouldn't be a problem. He no more left and had been gone hardly no time at all when the place was on fire again. And then that's when I called the fire department and then had them, I called him, told him to get home, the house, you know, the laundry room was on fire. And it done damage to, like, it busted the door. The door was like, here's the laundry room, here's the carport, and here's the side door that goes into the den. It popped the door and done smoke damage, you know, to it. But I had a sectional there. And the only thing that was damaged was right there where the sectional was. It did blaze it a little bit. But the sectional was taken to Hall's Run to a friend of mine, and her children used it after the fact. They cleaned it and used it, so it wasn't even burnt to the point that it could not be used again.
Now, if you're wondering why Pam is explaining the limited damage caused by the fire, it's because that fire was probably the prosecution's second biggest point of emphasis at trial, behind only the drowning of Johnny Ray. Why? Well, this takes us back to the doctrine of chances. The Ludie Brown House was insured by the North Carolina Farm Bureau Insurance Company, and Dorian was the vice president of the Duplin County Farm Bureau Federation. And so, despite the fire in the house merely causing minor damage, Dorian was able to get it declared a total loss, meaning that Pam and he got an insurance payout of just over $140,000. If you want to know how this fire was portrayed at trial, this clip from Deadly Women with SBI agent Blake Wallace and prosecutor Pat Murphy will give you a pretty good idea.
Pam was home alone.
Dorian!
And a fire broke out.
Oh, damn, this my house!
Pam manages to escape the burning farmhouse.
Oh, baby, are you okay?
Yes.
Dorian and Jackie do their best to save the homestead.
They run back over there, and by this time, the house is engulfed. The house was basically a total loss.
Essentially, every witness I've spoken to disputes this characterization of the fire. For example, here's Pam's mother, Shirley.
And if they will read the notes from the trial, I don't have any of it now. It's in there that where they said up there on the stand that they totaled the house, but the reason they totaled it is because Dorn was on the board.
Right, so they made it seem like a much worse fire than it actually was.
Oh, yes. It was in the den and in the laundry room. And it did turn the ceilings and all kind of smoky in the kitchen part and everything. But they went in there and cleaned the house. And they took the furniture. In fact, I've got a piece of furniture right here of it right now.
A couple months ago, journalist Phoebe Zerwick went to the Ludie Brown house with Pam Hatcher, the EMT who came to the Lanier house on the night that Doran died.
So tell me your name and then tell us where we are and what you see here.
Pam Hatcher. Uh-huh. We're at 603 Ludie Brown Road. The house is standing, and it did not completely burn, and supposedly she burned this house to the ground.
Why?
For money.
And did this come up at the trial?
Several times.
And what did they say about it at trial?
She was alone, and she was the only one here when the house burned, so therefore, she burned it.
And what did they say about how the house was burned?
Totally destroyed.
And what?
And the contents.
And what do you see here?
Brick structure, old, same house that was here before.
So the only thing...
And people live in it. They've rented it since they sold it. Mm-hmm. The guy
and
that
from what
owned
you
it.
Remember, what part of this house was burned?
The laundry room that was separate from the living quarters.
And did you come see it after it?
Yes, ma'am.
With her?
No, not with her.
Okay.
I came.
Okay. So this is sort of like part of the... What do you think this is? Part of the story that...
The prosecutor to determine motive was monetary gain. So they used her burning this house.
As an example of mm-hmm. the first time that she did something for monetary gain?
No, this would be the second. Killing Dorn was the second. This would be the first time.
Right, yeah. So the first time.
Yeah, to show intent or whatever.
And as far as you know, this house has been occupied for the last 20 years with, mm-hmm. and
yes, ma'am.
Didn't have to be rebuilt.
No, ma'am.
Okay, thanks.
No.
It's not surprising that Pam Hatcher came away with this impression of the evidence after attending trial. If you just read the prosecutor's opening statement and closing argument, your takeaway would be that Pam intentionally started this fire to benefit financially, making it likely that she killed Dorn as a type of double-dipping. But that's very different from the argument that Pat Murphy made in arguing to the judge that evidence of the fire was admissible outside the presence of the jury. It's actually the first subject covered in the trial transcript. According to Murphy...
So, the relevance of the fire and their prior... in the Ludie Brown residence, is that it is a fact that during the course of their marriage, that marriage residence was destroyed, and they got $140,000 as a result of an insurance settlement on that, and then used that money to, shortly before his death, purchase a brand new home. And then that's the position they were in shortly before they died. We don't intend to show that she actually set the fire. The circumstances of the fire, I believe, are relevant, but we don't intend to try to show here she actually is the one who set the fire to cause that residence to burn.
Instead, according to Murphy, evidence of the fire was admissible under the doctrine of chances. In other words, what was the likelihood that Pam would benefit financially from a fire at her house, and then benefit financially from the death of her husband over the course of a year, with both the fire and the death being accidental? In later upholding this decision on appeal, the Court of Appeals of North Carolina would hold that, quote, the Ludie Brown fire evidence, along with the evidence of Johnny Ray Williams' death, strengthens the application of the doctrine of chances and lessens the probability that Dorian Lanier's death occurred as an accident.
But we've already noted that Pam thought that Johnny Ray's life insurance policy had lapsed at the time of his death, and there are real questions about whether Pam benefited from Doran's death. Pam and Doran had contracts with Nash Johnson & Sons to raise turkeys, and Pam estimates that they were taking home about $20,000 every few months from those contracts. And while Pam was able to handle certain parts of being a turkey farmer, she needed Doran's help for other parts.
In terms of your turkey farming, what's life like with you being a turkey farmer?
Disastrous. I'm not very good with the turkeys. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. But I knew what to do. You know, I knew to go through the turkey houses, and we would pull out the dead ones, you know, and get them ready to be picked up and taken. Well, I'm being honest. Pick up, and I knew if I wanted a turkey, this sounds gross, y'all. Please don't listen. Don't think me the worst. If I wanted a turkey for supper or something like that, I like the breast of the turkey. I would kill one of the turkeys and skin it and take the breast and clean it. I mean, I'm kind of a country girl. I mean, but now he took care of the medications and things like that because me and Tammy didn't know what to do. We went through them and picked them up, you know, and got rid of them. And if we thought they were sick, we would let Matt or Doran know, you know, something, or even Lewis. Lewis worked with us.
And so when Doran died, so did those turkey contracts.
And so, you know, financially at this point, you have these turkey contracts. What happens?
By the time I go to court, I don't have no turkey contracts.
Right. When do those end?
It was right after he died. It was not long after he died. There was no turkey contracts.
And they did that because they knew that he couldn't.
He couldn't. His contract had nothing to do with me. And the one up there, we couldn't handle it, so we didn't keep it. Right. I mean, there was no reason to keep it. Two women can't do it, and, you know, not with children.
Right.
No.
So while it is true that Pam got some property after Doran's death, she also lost her primary source of income. So claiming that Pam killed Doran for financial gain seems a bit of a stretch at best. Many also claim that the idea that Pam would have killed Doran is not just a stretch, but shocking. Here are some clips from interviews that Wake Forest journalist student Natalie Wilson did with people who knew Pam and Doran. First, we have Pam's daughter, Kayla.
They had a great relationship. Like I said, I never saw them, not one time argue. My mom never really cussed or anything, neither did he. So, and she doesn't raise her voice. That's what I'm saying. Like, when we get in trouble, she could just look at us. And we would know, like, to stop because she never raised her voice. So they never, she still doesn't raise her voice. Like, she just has never done that. So I never saw them get an argument, ever.
Next, we have Kayla's cousin, April.
I never saw, I mean, Doran, he just thought she was the best thing ever. And she seemed to think he was too. They always were happy. They never argued when I was around. She was a great mother and she was a fantastic aunt.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know how any of this could have even been told any other way.
Yeah.
I mean, she took care of everyone.
And finally, we have April's brother, Mitchell.
Doran absolutely adored her. I mean, he thought she was everything in the world. And Pam, she's the same way towards him.
Now, Mitchell isn't just speaking about the general relationship between Pam and Doran. He's also talking about the 2 months between early September 1997, when Doran had his bulldozer accident, and November 19th, 1997, when he died from arsenic poisoning. Mitchell was there constantly for those 2 months, helping out with the farm. And we'll hear more from him next episode when we delve into those last 2 months of Doran's life. But for now, the key takeaway is that the way that people saw the relationship between Pam and Doran helps explain why suspicion didn't initially fall on her, despite the determination that Doran had died from arsenic poisoning. Here's Pam Hatcher describing the interactions between Pam and Doran's family after his death.
His family included her in everything from that November to April. I thought that was very odd. If I thought you killed my brother, you wouldn't be in my house. I wouldn't be in your house. You know, they did. They had Thanksgiving. They had Christmas. They had baby showers, weddings she was invited to. Yeah.
When I first talked with Pam Lanier on the phone, she struck a similar chord, asking me whether I'd have dinner with her if I thought she'd poisoned my brother.
I followed up with her on this subject when I met with her attorney and her in prison, and it was clear she'd asked him the same hypothetical.
In the months after Doran has passed away, it's my understanding that you had, like, Christmas dinner with them and
that Christmas idea, well. Yes. That goes back to that conversation you had with me. You said, hell no, I would not eat your table. You remember that? You told me, hell no, I wouldn't eat at your table. You remember
you
that?
Killed,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
I will always. I remember him saying that when he met me. He said, he said, hell no, I wouldn't. But we did. They, his father gave us our Christmas, and Scotty, his brother, they all come over and ate Christmas morning with us, his father and his stepmother, just like we always did. We always would do it on Christmas morning, and they'd come over there Christmas morning and ate. Now, if you thought I killed your brother or your son, would you be at my table eating?
Well, that's
it is what it
is. So, again, between November 1997 and early April 1998, everything was fine between Pam and Dorian's family. Pam no longer had the lucrative turkey contracts, but she was doing her best to make ends meet.
Social Security, and I was working at the car lot. And then I was also working with Danny. I would do clean his shop up on weekends, his barbershop. Well, it wasn't a barbershop. It was a shop for women and men. I would clean his shop up. And then one of the real estate companies in Jacksonville would call me when they needed houses cleaned, and I would go do their houses for them.
For a while, Pam was able to make things work with the help of her parents and another couple. Here's Pam's mother, Shirley.
Up there after Dorn died, we stayed up there during the week, and another couple would stay on weekends. And it was just too much for us. We told her we had to come home. We stayed up there for about a year like that, and we told her we just could not keep it going. But that she had to do something.
And so, in April of 1998, Pam made the decision to sell some farm equipment that was in her name to Doug and Wanda Lanier, and an option to purchase the farm for $225,000. And with that, the relationship between Pam and Dorian's family fundamentally changed. Once again, here's Pam's friend, Lisa Padgett.
Then, all of a sudden, it started coming around, and they all wanted, because she had to sell some of the farm, to be able to pay off a big building that they had built, you know, because it was in her name and she had to pay that building off. So she had to sell some stuff, some equipment and stuff. Well, then that's what started stirring the pot right there.
Right, so in other words, the family wasn't happy when she started selling off some of this property.
Yes, yes. And they were not happy with the person that she sold it to.
And who is the person she sold it to?
Doug Lanier.
Okay, and why weren't they happy with her selling it to Doug Lanier?
Because they didn't like Doug. Because he's one of those people that will speak his piece and he'll tell you what's what. And they didn't like that.
And here's Pam's niece, April Everett.
And the family, his family loved her until she got left his land. Or in his, in the house and stuff. Like, literally, she did stuff with them all the time. All the neighbors, everyone. Everyone loved her. And then when she wouldn't just hand them over his farmland or whatever, That's when everyone just, like, turned on her.
And here's Pam herself.
And then what happens to the relationship between Doran's family and you after
this day
of selling to Doug?
They didn't have nothing else. That was it.
And so you think that because you were trying to sell it, they...
I think so.
Talking to you. Yeah.
I think it had a lot to do with it.
In describing Chinkapin, where all this took place, Pam's attorney, Mark Rabel, found a metaphor for her case based on what we've just heard.
A lot of little family plots, cemeteries, which I'm thinking that's probably a good name for the case, family plot, because the case itself seems to me is evolving into this thing where the family, Dorn's family, basically was okay with Pam and wasn't thinking she was a suspect until she put the land up for sale that she would have been inheriting. And that's when the investigation and the accusation started getting going in earnest. And so it's like family plot. Not that we're saying anything remotely like his family was responsible, because they really had very little to do with him. And there apparently was a lot of resentment with Dorn, her husband, the guy who died, because he bought the property from his parents. Initially, the plot of land, which is when we found, we went to the land, and it's actually much more beautiful than all of the land around it, because it's everything else is flat except for this little area, and it's like sort of a little valley with all these beautiful trees and, you know, lots of acreage. Beautiful, beautiful spot. And the parents had initially given it all to, like, the five kids, but then had to get it back to borrow against it. And then somehow Dorn ended up with it. I'm thinking he bought it from them, but he ended up with it in his name. So there's a lot of resentment about the land.
Rabel's comments call to mind the Alfred Hitchcock movie Family Plot, with the film's double entendre title referencing both a literal family plot in a cemetery and the drama that can divide a family. When a family member has died, there's perhaps nothing that can divide a family more than the filing of an action under the state's Slayer statute. So what exactly is a Slayer statute? For an illustration, consider another case involving the possible wrongful conviction of a North Carolinian. In 2006, Michelle Young was found dead in a house that she shared with her husband Jason and their toddler daughter. Jason stood to receive $4.2 million in life insurance from his wife's death, but her family blocked him from getting that money by getting a judgment under North Carolina's Slayer statute.
Within the civil statute, this defendant, Jason Young, to be the slayer, that is that he unlawfully killed Michelle Marie Fisher Young, within the slayer, within the definition of slayer in the civil law. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In other words, if it can be proven that a family member was the slayer of the deceased, she's prevented from inheriting his money, property, and insurance proceeds.
And now we get into the twin meanings of the famous Godfather line from the introduction. Because whether it was Doran's family or the neighbors, immediately after Pam made the decision to sell and the lawsuit was brought under the Slayer statute, she and her family started getting harassed. Here's Lisa Paget.
Me and my husband, at that time, we would go up and stay every weekend with her because she was being, they were harassing her. They wrote on the side of her house. They would beat on the windows. They were just terrorizing her and those children.
Right, and we don't know exactly who was doing that, but it was taking place.
It was taking place, and the sheriff's department would be called up there, and they would come out. There weren't nothing really they could do, but they never really tried to do anything, never really tried to find out who it was.
Mitchell Sanders would stay with Pam and the kids at night because of the harassment.
At nighttime, some people would go up there and spray paint stuff on the house. I can't remember what it was, but I do remember it was spray painting the house.
While Mitchell doesn't remember exactly what was spray painted on Pam's house, another witness, Vivian Parker, has said they were black X's, bringing to mind the houses in post-Katrina New Orleans. Mitchell does, however, recall the effect the harassment had on the family.
It had the kids and her scared to death to even stay there at night, and that's why I continue to stay. And it just gets where it can just rattle your brain. It was just, it gets so crazy.
Vivian Parker says that Pam also started getting threatening calls from anonymous callers. For Mitchell's sister April, the harassment that Pam received has soured her view of Chinkapin for the rest of her life.
And I haven't been back there since.
Back to
Chinkapin. I don't drive by there. I don't do anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just think it's a horrible place.
Why do you think that?
Just because of the people there.
Yeah.
The way they treated my aunt.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's nothing there that I want to see.
When I talked with Pam about the harassment, the main thing she recalled was something with the closest parallel to The Godfather.
And around the same time, your family knew you started getting harassed.
Yes.
Can you describe what you experienced?
There was things wrote on my signs and stuff wrote on my door and looked like paint. My dog died. I had a bulldog. and I left one day, and he had a cage that was right outside that had been from Lowe's. You know, when I was home, he was in the house with us, but when we went, I put him out. And when I come home, somebody had put something in there to eat for him to eat, and it was not nothing I had put in there for him to eat, and he was dead.
Now, it's important to reiterate that we don't know whether it was Dorian's family or neighbors who were doing all of this. But it's also important to note that the state's initial decision wasn't to charge Pam with Dorian's murder. The district attorney at the time was William Andrews, and he candidly told Pam and her attorneys that there wasn't enough evidence to take her case to trial. But later, Andrews was replaced by a hard-charging DA named Dean Bowman, and Bowman decided to move forward with the case against Pam. And so, in January 1999, Pam was arrested for the murder of her husband.
How do you come to learn that you've been charged with murder in connection with Dorian's death?
Doug, he called me, and he told me, he said, I've got something to tell you. He said, where's your children? I said, they're at school. He said, where are you going now? I said, I'm fixing to go to pick them up. And at the time then, they were in Jacksonville at a private school, a Christian school there. And he said, is there anybody at the house with you? I said, no. He said, well, I've got something to tell you, but I prefer you not be home by yourself. I said, well, then you just need to tell me. And I said, I will be all right. Tell me what you got to tell me. I said, what's going on? And then he told me I was indicted. And he said, they're giving you 24 hours to turn yourself in. And he said, in the 24 hours, he said, I will call you back in a little while. Go get your kids. Tell your family. And he said, and then I'll call you back. And that's what he did. I had 24 hours to make arrangements for the children. And I was to meet him the next day at 10 o'clock. And he would carry me in. And I met him. I can't remember if it's Hardee's or McDonald's. It was one of those places. I met him there at 10 o'clock. And then me and him got in his vehicle. And we went to the sheriff's department together.
But it seems pretty clear that Bowman thought that he had a weak case. On October 11, 2001, he made Pam an offer she couldn't refuse. Here's a letter that Pam received from her attorney.
Dear Pam, this will confirm the meeting held at your parents' residence on Friday, October 11, 2001, to discuss a possible negotiated resolution of your case. As you well know, you were charged with a felony crime of first-degree murder, and the state is seeking the death penalty. Should you be convicted of first-degree murder, there are only two possible punishments, death or life without parole. On Friday, October 11th, 2001, Doug Parsons and I met with you, your parents, and your son Dustin to discuss a possible negotiated resolution of your case. The state would permit you to plead guilty to the felony crime of involuntary manslaughter and receive an active prison sentence of 20 months. Moreover, you'd be required to forfeit your rights to the property of Ivy Doran Lanier Sr. This plea would be predicated on the legal theory that you unintentionally caused the death of Ivy Lanier by an act of omission, i.e., that is, you failed to secure adequate medical care for Mr. Lanier in a timely fashion. This negotiated plea would not require you to admit that you intentionally caused the death of your husband. Doug and I carefully reviewed the evidence, applicable law, and our opinion regarding your case. Based upon a combined trial experience of 52 years and more than 400 jury trials, it is our joint recommendation that you take this plea.
But Pam did refuse the offer. So, 2 weeks later, the state came back and sweetened the pot. Under the second deal, Pam would enter the same plea and receive a sentence of between 16 and 20 months in prison. Once again, Pam said no. With both these offers being rejected, Dean Bowman then added some honey and some vinegar.
The third one, they said, that Bowman and Murphy said, if I did not take that plea, then they were going to charge me for Johnny's death. And I think it's in there, Johnny's death. They wanted me to sign it too. They said, tell her that if she doesn't sign it and we're going to court, then we're charging her for Johnny's death.
Pam's memory is accurate. The third plea deal says that if she pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter in connection with Dorian's death, she wouldn't be charged with Johnny Ray's death. And there was also something else in the plea bargain.
One of them had work release in it, that they would request work release, get the judge to request work release for me. That's basically what they told me.
And once again, Pam turned down the deal. That deal remained on the table, though, through the start of trial, when, one final time, the prosecution sweetened the deal once again.
And I saw somewhere in the paperwork that there might have been 6 months at some point in time, isn't it?
Yes, they even offered that in the courthouse.
So where was that?
In the courthouse during the trial.
So during the trial, they offered you 6 months.
Yes. Doug come and told me that they had mentioned even 6 months. Would I consider taking it? I said, no. Right. He said, are you going to say no for 6 months? I said the same thing I said no for the rest of it. I said it didn't happen, and I'm not doing it.
And how hard were they were your attorneys pushing you to accept the plea bargain?
Real hard. Doug was. Doug, matter of fact, got mad at me one time and slammed his fist down on the desk. He said, damn it, do you not know that you could die? If they find you guilty, that you're facing life or death. And I said, Doug, I'm not scared to die. I said, don't try to scare me because it's not going to work. I said, I didn't do it and I'm not signing those papers.
Pam's attorney, Doug Parsons, who later became a judge, has a similar memory.
We related back to her what our findings were. We begged her. Begged her, and then begging later turned to yelling at her about not considering the 16 to 20.
Pam Hatcher advised Pam Lanier not to take the plea deals, but now she second guesses that advice.
She called me. She said, I'm so upset. She said, I don't know what to do. I said, did you kill Dorn? She said, no. I said, then don't sign it. I wish she would have signed that last one. I really do.
But Pam Lanier has no regrets.
And obviously, I didn't do it, and that's a reason I'm not going to accept it. Were you thinking at the time they're going to have to find me not guilty, or were you thinking there's a real chance that I could be convicted here?
No. Honestly, I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I believed in the system. They weren't going to find me guilty. And even if today, and I've said this before in front of these two right here, my mom said if I had it to do all over again, she would break my hands and push a pin. She said, now that I would do. I don't even think I would sign nothing like that today because I didn't do it.
Right.
You know, I've been here 17 years. I didn't do it. So you know what? I can live here another 17 if I have to. I don't want to, but if I have to, I will, because I did not do it. It's the principle of the thing. They're trying to make me say something that didn't happen.
And so there you have it. Pam Lanier refused the offer she couldn't refuse. 6 months in prison that could be served on weekends in exchange for a plea. Not a plea admitting that she had poisoned her husband or even intentionally prevented him from getting medical care. A plea that she was reckless or possibly even just negligent in failing to get him all the medical care he needed. Without a plea bargain, the case continued through the trial, and just before Thanksgiving 2001, the jury found Pam guilty of murder.
So when this case goes to the jury and they're announcing this guilty verdict, was that surprising to you, or did you kind of expect that this would happen?
I knew it. I felt it.
The jurors, however, spared Pam's life and decided against the death penalty. That left them with just one sentencing option: life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. I asked Pam what her life has been like in prison.
It took me a while to get adjusted, because I was missing my home and my children. But I did get adjusted, and I turned out to be I got my apprenticeship in Dental Lab. I got Cosmo. I worked with Travel and Tourism for over seven years. I worked across the bridge that used to be the duplicate, and where they do the SBI files and stuff, the books. I was the secretary there. So I kind of knew what was going on the outside, what was going on in legislation with the bills and stuff, because we'd done it all there. I knew at some point in time that maybe, if not, I always told my bunch, they always would pick on me about school. And I said, well, there's two things that's going to happen in my life. Either I'll go home one day smart, or you'll walk by my coffin and say, she died smart. But either or, I said, I'm going to be all right. And I have here. I cannot tell you. They treat me just as good as gold. I work in Cut and Curl. There's six of us, does 500 and some women's hair here. I'm in charge of all the chemicals. They pay, they come, and I pull their colors. You know, the girls put them in, the other five girls along with me. And I cut. And I'm not saying this in a bragging way, but I'm good at what I do. I'm very good at what I do. So saying that, they don't push me in any way. They kind of know me by my first name. My unit manager, Miss Williams, she was the one that approved y'all. She's been very good to me. I don't get in trouble. The staff's very good to me. Yeah, I want to go home. But if I have to stay here, I would like to stay here. But if I have to go to Goldsboro, I go to Goldsboro. But either way, I'm going to be all right.
So far, you've heard two-thirds of the evidence presented against Pam Lanier at trial. The evidence connected to the drowning of Johnny Ray and the evidence connected to the fire at the Ludie Brown house. That leaves the final third. So what happened in the 2 months between Doran's bulldozer accident and his death that led the state to suspect that Pam had poisoned him, or at least there wasn't another plausible explanation for his death? Next time on Undisclosed.
Big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible and has made this series possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Dalhan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. A big thank you to AC Parham for helping with research on the Pam Lanier series. And also, Rebecca Lavoie will be hosting our addendum, so I'm pretty excited about that. Make sure to tag Rebecca in your questions, anything related to this case. Use the hashtag UDAddendum, and Rebecca Lavoie's Twitter handle is at REBLavoie, L-A-V-O-I-E. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at Undisclosed Pod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.